First up, we have Audrey Betcher is going to talk a little bit about the Cradle to Career program or initiative, and I know you've got some other speakers with you, so I'll let you kick it off.
Okay, so with me today is Elaine Case. She is a Rotarian and part of the initiative, and Gerald Pearson from the United Way. So this is a great lead-in from last week when we talked about compass points and how using data matters in our community, and you had asked, Randy, whether an example of an initiative that has looked at how other communities have been able to move the needle. And so that's exactly what Cradle to Career is all about. And so this actually started as the Rotary Clubs of Rochester had looked at the fact that over the years they've given almost $1 million to youth programs in the city, and they started asking, are we doing the right things and are we moving the needle? And it wasn't clear that we could answer that question definitively. And so that got the club starting to talk about where do communities move the needle, and as we looked at literacy as a way to do that. And that journey has taken us more than a year as we've looked at how can we do the best for Rochester, and looking at the Rotary Clubs, and all three of us are Rotarians, that we see the role of Rotary as convener. And in fact, as we get into this, you'll see that the Rotary Clubs of Rochester as well as the district are sponsoring an upcoming summit and paying for that. So seeing Rotary's role, and of course the library's role around literacy, it's important that we have a literate community, and also United Way will talk about how our paths converge. But to start with, some of the data around literacy, that we have 14% of the population that can't read, and 21% that read below fifth grade level in the United States. And 63% of prison inmates can't read. There's just a lot of statistics that talk about how important literacy is. And Rochester. It's not just a national trend, but it's also here within our own city that we've got only 31% of students come in that are kindergarten ready. And so that's 900 kids a year that aren't ready. We've got 500 kids a year that aren't reaching that third grade reading proficiently. And we have 300 kids a year who don't graduate from high school. And that has a huge impact on our city. And so why? An example is the impact on crime and law enforcement, that two-thirds of students who can't read proficiently end up in jail or on welfare. And the low literacy rates cost a lot. And there are states that estimate their prison population based on third grade reading level. And every time I hear that, it makes my heart sick. But it also has an impact on workforce. As you look at our workforce, we have very low unemployment rate. We have high labor force participation. And based on some numbers that came out of the planning department, the last ones that I saw said we have a labor force gap of 24,000 workers. We need to fill the jobs that are coming down, that we are projecting. We need everybody to succeed. We cannot leave people behind, but it also means we're going to have in-migration, and which of course means that we're going to continue to grow. And of course, the decisions that you're making about how the city grows has a huge impact on many different factors. If you look at transportation and housing and population density, concentrations of poverty, all of those have an impact on educational outcomes. It has an impact on everything, and low literacy, that's important for that too. So then, Elaine, I'm going to turn it to you and have you talk about some of as we went out on this journey of how do other communities move the needle. Elaine was absolutely instrumental in interviewing 10 other communities.
So the journey took us to an organization called Strive Together, which is a national organization. It's out of Cincinnati. And the way they started is pretty much just like we did, although instead of Rotary Clubs, they started with three universities saying, this is not an acceptable situation the students were getting, and what's the problem here in Cincinnati? So they started an initiative called Cradle to Career. And they've actually been working on that for 13 years. They've shown amazing results. We have some of those results. But what happened was all these cities across the United States were coming to them saying, wow, you've had a lot of success here. We want to do exactly the same thing. So they formed a national organization, and all that national organization does is basically consult with other cities and share among the cities doing this work. So there's now 68 of those across the United States. As Audrey said, we went and interviewed 10 of them to find out what did they do, how did they get started. It was actually fascinating. I told you about Cincinnati got started from university partners. Racine, Wisconsin started from the business community. So the business community said, we have low unemployment rate, we have big problems. The CEO of Case IH said, I'm going to have to move out of this city if we don't solve these problems. Red Wing started out of the Jones Family Foundation, who said, kind of like Rotary's looking at, they said, gee, are we really getting as much return as we need from the investments that we're making? And Racine actually just got a $100,000 Humphrey grant for their Red Wing. So we looked at all those models, and we'd been collaborating with the United Way, who'd been going down this exact same path that we had been, and done a lot of work around collective impact, which is the model that's used by Strive Together Partners. So we really started working together heavily in November, talking to many of the community that you'll see in a minute. And we came upon, that's how we kind of came upon this model, using a true collective impact model. And instead of just looking at kindergarten readiness as an example, which is where we started, we looked at the whole model cradle to career and said, this is the way to go to really build the long-term success and health of our community. So that's where we ended up. Very simply, collective impact is when you form a vision across your whole community. You agree to a set of outcomes, and then you align the work that's already going on. So as we've been talking to a lot of community members, a lot of the groups will say, well, we've already tried this in Rochester. We've already done this in Rochester. What's going to be different? And that's what's going to be different, is really getting alignment of all the work going on. There's a ton of work around workforce, around school readiness, around kindergarten readiness. We know we have 250 kids that are in poverty. They can't get into Head Start. We have these issues. But if we all align what we're doing around those common outcomes, we think that this will be a much better model and can be successful. But it's long term. It's not a 1-2 year kind of deal. It's long term.
Well, sure. I think very similar to the Rotary Clubs. The United Way of Homestead County, the Board of Directors has been thinking about evaluating how we might make a greater impact in the community. And as we think about the four building blocks to good quality of life, education, income, health, and basic needs, education is the strongest lever that we have to really raise all of the various facets of good quality of life. So educational outcomes are a strong predictor of health outcomes long term. The higher your education, the better you achieve academically, the more likely you are to earn a family-sustaining wage in the future, thus providing for your basic needs, and the virtuous cycle kind of continues. That said, students today, we now face an enormous amount of barriers, many of which exist outside of the school buildings. They're related to family situations, could be a mental health concern in the family, could be an unmet dental need for the student themselves. It could be that they haven't had a warm meal to eat for several days, or perhaps they haven't had a place to lay down their head on a consistent basis at night. All those factors are something that the community needs to respond to, and something that we believe the coalition is well positioned to help create long-term systemic change in, for the very reasons that Elaine and Audrey have mentioned. So we're very excited about this opportunity, and we think that the momentum that's building in the community around the coalition, around the aspirations of the coalition, is very exciting and contagious. And we're here today to seek your support and endorsement of the coalition. We're taking some baby steps as a community. We're initially asking for individuals to allow us to represent your support using, in this case, the city's logo on our written materials. But then also we're building towards a community summit on April 21st, in which Jeff Edmondson, the head of Strive Together, the organization that Elaine referenced, is coming to the community to share his wisdom and advice and experiences in having launched 68 of these efforts across the country. He'll come and have a public presentation on the 21st of April. So we would like to have your presence and visibility at the summit meeting. Again, as we start to build a coalition for the community, we all have a shared aspiration of improving educational outcomes. And we believe that the city is an instrumental player in demonstrating that we have a legitimate coalition put together. You know, United Way of Olmsted County hosted a variety of community conversations last year, and when asked for a variety of participants, if you were to believe community change were possible, so we asked participants what their aspirations were for the community, what changes they would like to see, and they, in response to the question, if you were to believe community change was possible, who would have to be involved in that effort? And common refrains were the police department, the city of Rochester, and other institutions that you might think of. And so as we build a coalition, these early stages are so critically important that we get broad support and endorsement for the aspirations of improving educational outcomes. And having city support and endorsement at this time would be, again, that's what we're here today to ask for your consideration of. And, you know, as the coalition forms more formally, we're kind of in the planning stages now. The April 21st meeting is a milestone. We anticipate that there will be more concrete plans that will mature from that summit, that all the coalition members at that point will have subsequent decisions to make. We're not yet sure what those might be, so we're asking for some early stage commitment just in terms of endorsement of the concept, your belief behind the practice of collective impact and what it means for our community to improve educational outcomes. And then we'll start taking some additional steps together, and we'll have independent decisions to make along the way. So that's a long bit. I probably covered all the ground.
That's
how United Way got here. Again, it's a kind of a strong lever point for us to create community change, and we believe that the only way that that's possible is if we put together a strong, broad coalition from all corners of the community.
But as so there are a number of organizations that have already committed, and for the city of Rochester does as well.
Mr. Bilderback?
Location and time of the 21st?
21st, the community forum is from 7 to 9 at Hill Theater out at RCTC.
What involvement does the school district have in this right now?
They've committed to be at the summit as okay. well.
Mm-hmm. And they are also involved in a number of efforts with the desire. They have the world's best workforce goals that are articulated. In fact, these numbers mm-hmm. come from the school district. So they have pretty strong goals set for improvements in educational outcomes. That again, while the school district and the parents are primary actors in a student's academic achievement, there are a number of community supports that are necessary to help those that are in need okay. achieve those outcomes. So that's where rallying community supports in concert with the school district is so vitally important to success.
Mr. Campion, then Ms. Borowska.
Go ahead. Well, I this makes a lot of sense. Certainly noble cause and everything. You had talked about, you know, already kind of tried this. You get kind of get that feedback. Tried this already, but the alignment is critical in this. So who's going to take the lead on the? It seems like there's a lot of players here, but it seems like you'd need a lead person, organization. And where's that going?
So in the early stages, you've got United Way of Olmsted County standing in kind of a temporary position until other organizations are willing and able to stand up. We do see multiple backbone functions being served, so we have to clarify that through the planning and the summit process, so we don't have all the answers. But we do see a few organizations standing in to fill the backbone functions where we need to make future decisions and commitments, I think, involves new resources. If there needs to be additional resources put against the long-term sustaining of alignment or not, it's something that the coalition will have to wrestle with. But again, I think that gets us into the summit conversation and planning. So, good question.
There's a follow-on meeting after the public summit for backbone-type partners, and our facilitator, Jeff Edmondson from Cincinnati, is going to actually lead that session for 4 or 5 hours in the afternoon. So that's when we'll be able to say, you know, who exactly will provide those functions. But it's a key point. If you don't have that.
Well, I guess as a follow-up question then, can you see it? I mean, if you're kind of projecting out, would it be one of these organizations that's there now, or would we be creating something separate that would be maybe a lead group out of all these users or investors?
In the 68 communities that have launched so far, it's gone every which direction, including both of those.
Okay.
So how we proceed as a community is something that really the coalition has to come together and have a
So it's unique to the community.
Yeah.
All right, thank you.
Mr. Campion.
So this is not going to come as news to you guys because it's your day job, but I am a firm believer that you are what you measure, and you become what you measure. So I love this effort from looking at the actual impact of how we're investing into the system. I'll ask afterwards, but I don't want to just be at the table in spirit. I think putting our financial resources behind this is a great investment because there's frankly no better way to ensure successful community down the road than to invest now in these on-ramps and frankly to help people be able to measure the output. So wholeheartedly support this initiative. Besides getting confused about the graphic, but which I brought up, I was really excited to see this in there because I think you hit on a few key points. You know, how closely this is correlated to going into kind of those juvenile crime paths, going down the wrong path, and how early you have to interdict in that to kind of have an impact. Just really, I think the key is alignment. I totally agree with that, but the key is also finding those people that are willing to kind of put up. And I for one, am willing to put up for this, and I think that I hope we can continue to be alongside you guys as you lead this, because I think a community that makes this a clear, strong message of what they're trying to do, that's what DMC is. You know, we're not going to do this unless we're successful at this retraining, re-careering, and growing local residents that want to fill these very important roles. So super excited to see this, really excited to watch it kind of develop, and hope I can get joined by the other council members to support it.
And the data piece is really critical. I mean, that's one thing that's in that collective impact model is it's shared data. And that means we're going to have to do things differently than we've ever done them before. And, you know, other cities have been working through some of the politics that goes along with it and the privacy issues that come with it, but you have to do it because, you know, there are a lot of programs that are really good programs, but when you say how effective are you, if you can't answer that question, then we have more work to do.
Well, and informing other people that they need to measure. In fact, like when I worked with United Way, it was just interesting to go through some of those organizations and ask them, because then you realize, they realize sometimes, oh, I should be measuring these things to figure out what the impact is. So I think it is informative, but it's also, you know, getting to the value for other investments we make and all your organizations make. So appreciate that.
Audrey talked about the year's worth of research we did, and we did a lot within the city, and we found every literacy project known to man, and there's some fantastic ones, but that was the issue, a little bit of siloing, and when you really dig into is what you're doing making a difference, we didn't really know.
Okay. The Argoyle T-shirt on the fifth person over is probably a bit much, but other than that, I love everything about this. I agree with Mr. Campion's comments. Enthusiastically support this. And one of the things that I'm kind of curious, you kind of alluded to, there's a lot of things that kind of overlap and are going on in the community. Some probably effective, some probably not. Could you speak a little bit about the opportunity to gain a lot of the benefit or support for this organization by perhaps replacing or better using some existing infrastructure?
Well, I do think that that's one of the potential benefits of having a broad, strong coalition of community members, organizations that's already kind of established, because right now, one of the challenges we have with communities, there are so many different efforts going on, but there isn't, when it says, well, what's the community say? There's nothing that's already set in place. Mm-hmm. So, the extent that we can put together a coalition, I think it provides a way for us to think about future efforts as a community. Mm-hmm. And to the extent that this organization has a desire to have improved educational outcomes, I think it provides a way to filter against, especially with the metrics in place and the shared data. So, to whether we can use existing infrastructure, I would hope that we can figure out ways to do that. But whether we can do it 100% or not,
and even if it's not at 100%, I'm certainly very supportive of what you're doing here. Like Mr. Campion said, I'm willing to financially support that. But, of course, the financial support, from my standpoint, comes with an expectation of transparency as well. And we understand that individual private data has to be protected, but the accumulated data is something that not only is it
good to share with the public, we'll probably achieve better results by having the public more involved.
And these 68 cities actually publish a yearly report card as part of their process. So I like that.
And that's important, but I do think it gets lost in the shuffle. Where the real change occurs is when we start creating feedback loops between the providers of educational academics, between the supports that are providing supports in the community, between it's connecting the dots where the dots don't connect today. So the annual reports are good and healthy, and we need to be doing those, but where the real change is occurring in the communities that I've studied, it's happening at the very individualized level between providers of supports, teachers, and administrators, which crosses boundaries. That left to just its own devices, they don't talk because of legitimate laws, but the communities that are finding ways to work within the confines of the law are figuring out ways to share anonymous data that leads to the right feedback loops.
And those are much quicker than yearly.
Rapid cycle.
And my editorial comment, I think we do things fantastic from elementary school on up for those kids that come into elementary school prepared. But boy, you talk to parents in this community in terms of finding affordable daycare for middle-income people. It's incredibly difficult, and I think the weak chain in the system right now is how some of the kids are coming in prepared to elementary school. And boy, if we could address that, we could conquer the world.
31% is really not acceptable.
I agree.
Okay. Where is an 80% graduation rate?
I agree. Thank you.
All right. Anyone else? Mr. Mayor?
If my calendar's right, just to point out that the 21st of April is when you're having your council retreat.
We moved it a week.
Perfect.
Yeah. Actually, we got moved back to the
28th.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah. No, no, no. Okay. Our retreat moved.
Our retreat moved.
Right?
Yes.
Well, that's correct.
Okay.
I emailed Aaron and said, this is the 21st. Please can we move back?
Right. Yeah, that's why we moved it.
Yes, so I appreciate you.
I hadn't heard that.
Okay.
Right. So thank you.
You're still invited.
I might come then.
Okay.
One final comment, kind of an example of the appetite this community has. I was in a meeting early this morning where they were talking about CTEC, which is just nicely up and running, and they were told to the first couple of years to expect 200 to 500 enrollees as it starts to get off the ground. The superintendent said this morning that for the next school year, they're expecting 1,600 enrollment.
All right.
So they're a little concerned they might have to come back and ask for an expansion. So
that's a good problem.
There's a need. All right. Anything else?
Do we need to codify our support with a motion?
You can't make motions out of committee.
You know.
Do it tonight under other business.
Oh, okay. We need to have a formal motion.
Yep.
Got it.
Can you put one together for us?
I'm sure you can.
Can you put one together for us?
What's the answer? Motion to support.
There you go.
Second. Nailed. Oh, wait. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right.
What? Well, what's the ask? What are we talking about? Tonight, I think it was just a lot of Susan.
There's no money involved at this point.
Oh, okay. All right. I thought there was
a court.
We'd show up and they can use the logo.
All right. Moving on to our next item, which is the Commons on Mailwood plant fee. And Mr. Quenville, you wanted to lead off on this.
I just want to talk a little bit about what my involvement was in this matter. And some of my thoughts about it. That's a little less than a year ago, Richard came to me and indicated they had this check, I think, for $235,000, and talked about the fact that, you know, after the project was proceeding, the PIF calculation method was changed. Talked about whether or not it should be returned or should be brought to the council for some consideration. Richard recommended that we return the check and that there would be others that would be involved in the similar situations, and therefore I agreed with that. But I've come to regret that. I regretted that almost at the time that I did it, or indicated we return a check. Rather, I should have brought it to you, and if I brought it to you, I would have recommended at that time that you accept the check that was submitted, because We had a development meeting on this project way back in 2015, at which time that PIF calculation was at least talked about. And I do believe that the city organization at least has some obligation to indicate to those people, that those applicants that are coming forth, if any changes are coming forth in these regulations that would cost the applicant additional monies. In this particular case, the applicant proceeded under the assumption that they had a certain PIF calculation methodology to fulfill. The PIF calculation was changed, and they, but without, you might indicate that, you might say that, well, the developers or applicants should have known, but obviously you'd also say that probably the city organization had an obligation to inform the applicants of pending changes. So the applicant goes to closing, and they close, and then all of a sudden they find out they have come up with another $160,000. And I hope that we have changed that with our new development coordinator process, but in this particular situation, I do believe that the city had an obligation to at least inform the applicant of these changes, and I regret the fact that I did not bring it back to you at that time with a recommendation to accept the check that was presented by the developer. I don't know if Mike Deservis has any additional thing to add. Why don't you come up to here and I can...
It's a hot seat. Yeah, and I would like to stress that the general partners and owners and investors of this project are very appreciative just to have this audience, because in a lot of municipalities, you wouldn't be afforded this opportunity. So that is greatly appreciated. I was kind of, well, I'm not a general partner and owner of the building. I was kind of the one spearheading the project and getting it going and bringing together the general partners and the investors, and largely in charge of the front end work. And we did hold a development meeting, and we were aware of the three method PIF calculation. We were approved in July of that year, and we submitted for our site development plan in October of that year. We kind of got everything approved. We submitted for the building footing foundation permit that January, around the 15th or middle of January, sometime of 16, unaware that the PIF calculation had changed. So then we did get to closing in about this time of last year, and we closed and sent the check down. And I was surprised to hear that there was a problem with the fees. Mark Baker and I worked on figuring it out and figured out that was a problem with PIF. And it created, if we would have known earlier, it would have been able to been budgeted for. And if it would have been, say, in the range of a smaller amount, maybe $30,000 to $50,000, it would have been much easier to swallow. But even though these are large projects and you have a contingency built into them, you would be surprised at how quickly those contingencies dry up. And prior to us even having a shovel in the ground, you know, to have a $160,000 hit to the project was kind of tough and made for an uncomfortable 2 weeks for a number of us involved. But that said, you know, I understand fees change, and not here to point fingers in any way. Enjoy doing development in the city. So it's just, as a fiduciary responsibility to all the parties involved, had to at least bring the request forward. And I appreciated Steve's help in this process. So feel free to ask any questions.
Mr. Bilderback? Steve, Richard, maybe you can help with this. When typically do we tell them they need to pay, or was that something that they did typical? And then I guess the confusion I have is, when's the typical time that we expect payment?
Payment since January of 2004 has been required at the time of complete application for building permit is submitted. In this particular case, that was May 13th of 2016.
Do we typically talk to the developers and tell them what their fees are going to be?
At the pre-development meeting, which occurred early in 2015, there's a general discussion of the fact that there's WAC and SAC and this and that that are due. There isn't really any detailed discussion as to the amount. I don't even think at that time they knew how many units they were proposing. So there's just a general discussion of these charges will be due, but there is no calculation. And in the case of PIP, it isn't calculated until after building safety. receives a complete set of plans. The PIF was actually calculated 4 days later on May 17th. It was never calculated by the city prior to that time.
And if I may clarify, we did engage a third party, WSB, in October, the fall of that year, which is normally our standard operating procedure. Maybe it's incorrect. Since we did have a contractor that didn't work in Rochester previously, as Richard said, you know, the PIF fee is tied to building permit. We contracted with WSB at that time to give us a summary of what our fees were, PIF, SACWAC, stormwater, participation, all of those.
Mr. Campion?
Just so that was going to be my follow-up question, because it seemed like there was some discussion, because you cut a check that for, I think, 7 out of the 8 fees was like within a couple $100s, and then this one was way off. So how did, I didn't see like a invoice. What you're saying is WSB gave you an estimate and you just paid based off of what they told you it would cost.
Yeah, since they're accustomed to working with the city on fees and they have a lot of communication with staff, that's customarily how we've proceeded rather than they're more direct and can figure it out better than likely we could, just given their experience. Yep. So that's how we approached it, and that's why we were comfortable. You know, we paid them to do that service, and we were comfortable with the fees. So. And I'm not saying that it's their fault either. I'm not blaming anybody. It just is a timing issue.
Mr. Pilbeck? But you said the fees looked like they were all close, except for the fact that we changed the way the city, calculated it.
Correct.
That was that third, the last one to be off.
That was changed at the end of the year of, I guess that'd be 15. And so we only submitted for footing and foundation permit in January. So Richard is correct that the full building permit was likely submitted later in the spring.
Question for Richard is has that been a past practice where a development project might remit their fees ahead of, or do they all wait until they get invoiced?
Turn to Mark, since he kind of handles most of those circumstances.
I would say 99%+ wait for an invoice. There have been a few cases over the years where a developer paid, our normal fees adjust August 1st every year. There would be some times where a developer would pay July 31st for something he was going to be invoiced for in August to secure those lower rates. But it was unusual when the courier showed up with a check for $687,000. I wasn't really sure what it was for. But we worked through it. We figured out, you know, what it included, but it just wasn't the numbers that we would have come up with.
Okay. Mr. Woodrick?
When did the policy change?
You actually adopted a resolution on October 19th of 2015 that changed the sewer utility rates for 2016 through 2020 and the changes to the PIF. And the actual document that came to you in the RCA shows those sections of the ordinance that were proposed to be changed by lineouts.
And when did WSB provide their recommendation? Or the recommended numbers?
It's my understanding from the documentation that's been provided by the petitioner here, or applicant, is the next day, October 20th.
Oh. This is...
That's based on what Mike wrote is October 20th. He received information from McGee and Betts.
And that's probably about correct. I think we probably, when we submitted the site development plan, we engaged them. And then they would have provided a summary along with their civil engineering work. So
that's just a coincidence, we're thinking?
It's not.
I mean, that's kind of a tell here that I'm concerned about is, during this time, how many projects do we think we went through and invoiced based on the new number? Probably 100% of the projects besides this one, correct?
Well, no invoicing occurs until after complete set of plans is submitted to building safety. And so, and the rates didn't go into effect until January 1. So there would have been no immediate invoicing of the new rates or charges or calculations for PIF until January 1st and any plans that were submitted to building safety after that time.
Mr. Ruskin?
Could the fee have been paid after October 15th before December 31st in that timeline?
Yes.
So if they had known that it went up, they could have paid it then. To like, yes. I think Mark said that there's a lot of July 31st for August 1st rate adjustments. So if they'd have been aware of this, they would have. They could have. Could you not have paid it before the
right.
end of the year?
It would have, mm-hmm. if we would have been aware, probably they would have chosen to pay it prior to save the money. But. Mm-hmm.
So we don't reach out at all to any in when the adjustments are going to be made on that, or is that just theirs to know? Or
well, WRS being new, right?
Yeah.
I mean, they provided the new the information.
The direct answer to your question is that we did not reach out and notify who knows how many different people in various stages of the development application process as to the changes.
The normal, the other charges that get adjusted every year, historically that's about 3%, 3.5%. We don't reach out to people for those other charges either, but they know what date it is and they know that it's usually about 3 to 3.5%. This is a little more unusual than that.
And we chose not to make that change on July 31st.
The PIF has never been July 31st.
It's never tied in on same dates.
They same tied to sewer rates, and those are adjusted on January 1st.
Yeah. Hmm. All right, Mr. Wojcik.
So with the sewer rates, even with the higher amount, if I recall correctly, we're not coming close to recouping our cost still.
Well, I think PIF is accomplishing the objective that the council set out for it in 2004. It's raising revenues to offset capital expenses that were incurred in the 2006 expansion.
But
I don't know that, where we are as far as the total amount of debt that's been paid. But
still, here.
Don't let me add.
We're still heavily subsidizing the PIF rates, aren't we?
Mr. Martin, have a comment?
I don't have one. I'm trying to understand the question yet.
Yeah, I mean,
but no, we have not covered the cost of the reconstruction expansion of the sewer facility from our PIF charges yet. If that's what you're asking.
Some of that is also due to there was a slowdown in building for a while, so that
we went through a number of years where it dropped off.
So it might have been both.
My understanding is that the current development levels, even, we're not covering.
You'd have to have a PIF be many times what you have now to do that.
Right.
And obviously, you know, you do cover some of the cost of the treatment plant through that process, but PIF does make housing less affordable, whether it's renters or single family.
I disagree with just about everything you said there, and we have numbers that back this up. But
it's bound to make a fee. I mean, somebody pays for that cost. And the renter pays for it, or the homeowner pays for it.
It doesn't necessarily germane to the topic.
Yeah. So, where I'm going with this is, nobody likes the process where somebody thinks they're getting one number and then it goes to the other. Although, the fact that WSB put out a note on October 20th, after we changed rates on October 19th.
Do we know that for a fact?
That's
he just said it.
That's what Mike said.
I would have to look back at the dates, but.
We should know whether or not it's really.
That's what he just said.
I mean, I
did you know that, Richard?
I gleaned that from Mike's letter to the council.
I do think there's an opportunity to work with the developer, because I don't like the way that this went down, but at the same time, I'm really bothered by that. My concern is we're already. Ultimately, we're not covering our costs, and somebody's paying the difference. It's either the developer or the taxpayers, or the remaining ratepayers. And this has been a challenge for a long time. So, I'm open to some flexibility. I think there's some other things we could do too. But boy, that's a tell.
Mr. Freeze, Mr. Bogabat.
And Terry's two favorite words are work with, but
yes.
But as you deliberate today, there's two important things from my perspective, that if you are going to quote work with the developer on something, point one is a point that Ed raised with Mark today, and it's the fact that the calculation of the payment still is based on the payment that was made, is still short based on the 2016, what did not use the 2016 rates, it used the 2015 rates.
Oh, okay.
So there's still a shortage there that would be owed of $37,500. The second point is that if you are to, quote, work with and allow a payment of less than the $158,000 and some dollars, we would ask that you do that by resolution, and that resolution point out specifically what's unique about this circumstance and what is so that it doesn't become in any way perceived as precedent setting. And again, that's advice from our esteemed city attorney. When issues like this come up, we don't want this to be precedent setting for any other example if you're going to work out something other than full payment.
Okay, I've got Mr. Bildebeck and Mr. Campion.
Yeah, I think 2016 rates would make sense to me. And I think it just, the point is buyer beware in the future. I mean, I appreciate the city saying some of this is our fault, but some of it is the people we're doing business with too. You would have thought that they would have stayed up on it and known. So I agree with Richard that we should do it by resolution, by what the city attorney has suggested. But my trying to get this to move along, my compromise would be have them pay the 2016 numbers, what it would have been at that point, and then
That's $273,300.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Go up a little bit. But that would
2015. That's a 16%. It's a 16% increase from what they paid.
Right. That would be the 2016 numbers.
Or what?
Right. I think the net is $37,500.
$37,500. Yep. And then 16%.
Mr. Campion.
I'm just trying to get like a rational understanding here. I mean, we wouldn't, if another consultant told an applicant that they would get $0 PIP fee, we wouldn't just accept someone reinterpreting our rules and saying what the fee would be. So they hired someone to inform them about what the cost of doing development was, and they were informed incorrectly. And I don't know, it is a precedent, and it's concerning to me that we would assume responsibility for what a consultant informed them. I don't like seeing it go up. We didn't like seeing raising it on residential or on, you know, individual owners when they were participating in the system. But it is what it is. I would have a real hard time justifying altering this because the applicant got bad information from their consultant.
Mr. Quinvold and Mr. Ruskin.
Well, I think one of the points I was trying to make, and I do think the organization has some obligation to the applicant in the process, if something's changed and they know it, to indicate that.
We never invoiced him, though, right?
Well, but they were had pre-development meetings, shouldn't they know that they're looking at some change? I think that'd be a normal obligation of the organization that you should embrace, that if one of your staff members is going to be making a recommendation to change something that affects their fee, then that should be probably indicated in the development meeting. Okay. And hopefully that will be changed in the future. And secondly, Mr. Zerbe's had some reluctance to bring this forth because he's doing other things in the city and doesn't want to get, you know, ill feelings. Yeah. But I don't think an applicant, and I encourage him to bring it forth, why? Because you shouldn't worry about any retribution of any kind. And thirdly, you know, this particular development had a significant parkland dedication fee because there was a land subdivision. If there's no land subdivision, no parkland dedication fee. And I think that's something you should look at going forward. There should probably be some sort of dedication fee, perhaps in the same circumstance, not just if you don't subdivide, you don't have it, but if you subdivide, you have it.
Okay.
Same kind of housing.
Take Mr. Hickey, then Mr.
Sorry. So I was going to see at this point, I mean, there's been discussion going with the 2016 rates, which would be a $37,500 difference. Is there a consensus for that? Move this along? I would support that.
Mr. Ruskin.
Yeah, I think that, you know, there was a pre-development meeting and items submitted by the application, or by the applicant. I know in talking, Mr. Zerbis, he said that there's some possible changes in parkland dedication, which they've been made aware of by the park department. I think this communication is a big part of this. You know, if we would have had the communication that there was a pending change in the rates, I think this whole thing wouldn't have happened. They'd have been aware of it. I think they would have probably got in their fees by the end of the year and not had to go through this. So I'd like to see, you know, some type of common sense come up with some type of thing that everybody can support or some type of an outcome everybody can support. But I'm open to other suggestions.
I'm willing to go with that consensus because I do think it's conceivable that the developer, having known the schedule of fees and been properly informed by their consultant, would have made the rational decision to pay them in 2016, so I can live with that. I say that fully understanding that these fees are still heavily subsidized, and that's, we've had the data in front of us for many years. Mr. Martinson's verified that over time. It's something that we're going to have to figure out how much we're willing to subsidize these type of things going forward. I have no issue at all with Mr. Zervis bringing this forward. I think it's good government that we hear that. Love the projects you're doing in the city, so if there's any fear of retribution, it's just that we hold you to high standard because you keep delivering us good projects. I do think I'm bothered when I hear, well, I think there's an obligation for staff to bring this forward. If that's how we need to be operating, great. Write the policy, the council will enact the policy, and then we'll have government do it the way it was intended. Otherwise, I don't like this hindsight, should have, would have, could have. We know how to enact policies. We can do that in a fair and just way. But that's it. I can live with the 2016 rates.
Okay. Just out of curiosity, did the same consultant come up with all these other estimates, or only the fifth?
Correct. Yeah, it was given. So yeah. Like when we did the waters on Mayo, we did the same process too. And, okay.
So obviously,
I mean, you know, that from now on probably won't.
We were off on the fifth, obviously,
approach,
because of the change in fee structure. Mr. Bildebeck, and then Mr. City Attorney has it.
Yeah, I think the nice thing is, once something that we may have forgotten, they paid in advance. I like this. I like to see developers actually sending us checks before we have to invoice them. And I think the thing is, too, you got to understand, that was they were trying to do the right things, too. So even though this got a little confused and a little screwed up, the fact is the intent was good, and I like the fact that they made efforts like that.
Mr. Atkins?
I can feel the law of unintended consequences breathing down from me right now. That's why I like the idea of putting this on a council agenda with an actual resolution, documenting the reasons why you're taking this action in this case so that another case can be distinguished in terms of the facts. And so I would assume that Richard and I can use the consensus you've reached in preparing that resolution, and I'll need, Richard, a recitation of the unique factors and facts in this case.
And I would like a recitation of that as well.
That's the beauty of this idea. You have the prepared resolution for the March 20th agenda, and you'll be able to see the recitation of facts, and you'll be able to vote based upon that recitation.
Yeah. And I agree, because that's imperative, so that we are not setting a precedent that is not desirable.
Mr. Zerbes, I want to say unequivocally, though I strongly disagree with the position the council is taking, you will never face retribution from me in any way. And I would say that to any developer who has ever been before me for any reason. So don't fear that, and we should be delivering that message to every developer. There's no reason to fear retribution for coming before us and at least begging the question. We deserve to talk about it. That's what reasonable people do in a democracy, so I appreciate that.
And I appreciate that too, Mr. Campion. I just know that everybody's overworked in the city right now, so bringing forward something like this probably seems like a pain in the butt. And I don't want to.
What do we do for a living?
Yeah. So I just and I don't want to create undue work for staff or any issues, because I enjoy all the people that I work with in the city of Rochester. So it's fun for me. I enjoy it. So.
I would certainly encourage you to have a little sit down with WSB on that fee schedule as well, and I'm sure you have already. But you know, I do appreciate what you're doing.
So, Mr. Ruska, it's your ward. I'll let you have the last word.
Well, I think that you know this only really makes sense if we figure out how to fix this. Is there any way that we can have a mailing list of all of the potential people that are out there, all of our consultants and so on, and when these things are, we send a email off to them informing them of this? It doesn't sound like we're communicating it a lot right now. And that's the best way to resolve this.
Is that on a public agenda?
I mean, it sounds to me like something the Rochester area builders might be sending out, or, you know, like, these are things that
could we use them? I mean, you know, the thing is we can sit there and go, well, it's up to you to figure this out, but it's good business to try to figure out how to fix it, and through communication, I think we can.
There might be communication issues, but there wasn't a communication issue right here between the city and the consultant, because we passed the changes on October 19th. They sent the letter October 20th. They're paid to be informed. They were clearly informed.
So other than the PIP fee, Mark sends out a notice as you're requesting to all the developers, and not developers,
the
but
consultants.
Consultants.
And the developers
with the August 1st adjustments.
Okay.
Because PIF is a part of that, it wasn't included, but we can do that.
Yeah, I'm just thinking, add that to our future notices.
Yep.
Thank you.
What we ran into here was the pre-development meeting was April of 15. The applications were early October 15. You guys discussed it late October 15. There wasn't anything else that staff or the applicant saw in between that time and the time the change took place. So unless you just happened to think about notifying somebody, it wasn't on anybody's mind.
Okay.
So you have adopted rates now through 2020. Mm-hmm. So this will include it as part of what we send out. But again, you won't be asked to change the rates for another 3 years, 4 years.
Well, I do, and I just to finish up, I do appreciate, see Paul sitting back there, the fact that they've already kind of conveyed the information that the parkland dedication piece could be changing. I think the more that we get people aware of this and checking into it, then it's a better communicating process. So.
I am supportive of reviewing whatever policy for consideration the staff brings to us on this matter.
Okay. All right, so there...
I just like to make one point. The PIF is based on when they apply for the building permit.
Right.
I mean, we have a lot of preliminary meetings, and we don't lock in fees with them. It's based on when they apply for the permit. So they didn't apply for the building permit at Headwater until May of 2016. So, and they pay the building safety department at the time that we should permit those fees. They don't prepay them like they did here in the public works. So, I mean, if the preliminary meeting is the time that we're going to lock in those fees, that's going to be very difficult for us to know which ones we should be collecting.
No, that's specifically not the policy that I want to advocate for, because the preliminary meeting could happen years in advance of these developments. So it's extremely...
So in the circumstance that Councilman Oresta raises, they would have had to file their permit application in December in order to take advantage of that. So it wasn't just that they came in with a check. Again, they still have to follow the process that's in place, so there has to be a completed application for the building permit, at which time then the fees are calculated. That would have had to been done in December. I'm not sure in this case if the drawing package was complete to the extent that building safety would have accepted it, but...
We would have only been able to submit a footing and foundation permit, which is why the fees were paid at closing, because time was sensitive with getting in the ground as soon as possible. So the building footing and foundation permit had been submitted for in January, which I guess you could, it sounds like you could base the fee off of the due. Is that considered enough, or probably like what you're saying, you need a full building set? So we had only submitted for a footing and foundation permit, and the fees were sent at closing because the contractor was hoping to go down to the building department, at least be able to pull the footing and foundation permit shortly after closing, because time was of the essence of starting the project.
Ms. Johnson.
Just a quick question. Is it your business's practice, customary practice, to pay those bills or pay that ahead of time before being invoiced?
The fees?
Yes.
Well, largely, for the majority of them, it seems like you might have a fee that's due as a requirement of your plat being approved or to get your official site development plan approval. So, you know, it's kind of somewhat of a chicken and the egg game sometimes. You know, and I probably wasn't as clear, know myself that you didn't need to pay it until you went to pick up the application.
Okay.
I probably didn't know that. And part of the problem is, you know, if it would have been a general contractor who was used to working in Rochester, maybe you wouldn't even have that issue. But they were a Twin Cities firm who had never done a large project down here. So, you know, with it being tied to the building permit, that creates some issues too. And
you know, and along the same line, arguably you could have it go the other way too. Someone who's very savvy get their paperwork in ahead of a fee increase, and you know,
right.
So you can kind of play both sides of that.
Yeah, if we had hired Weiss to build it, you know, they're used to operating here. They would have been probably, well, you need to get this going, if they were aware of it, likely.
Yeah. Okay. Any, Mr. Campbell?
No, just that I don't think we should limit the discussion about when to have the fees. If there's some other vehicle to attach them to that makes more sense than the final plan coming through, what do other cities do? I don't want to limit us to a solution that is not perfect. Well, so
I'm still comfortable with, you know, when they actually apply for the building permits, that's a clear stake in the ground. Mm-hmm. I think the only missing component here was maybe that communication of the PIF fee change along with the other fees that we communicate, and we're going to rectify that someday.
And normally we adjust them in April or August.
January.
But what was the other one?
August.
Why don't we just lump this in and take it to August?
All at one time.
So we do them all at once.
Yep.
Yep.
We'll extend this one to 2020 August, and then the next one will come through with all the other rate changes. Perfect.
Is that great? Is that or what? It seems to make sense to us, but
yeah.
Or the other one, January.
Yeah.
Well, whichever.
I'll
but
do
they should all be at the same time.
I just think a good practice is this to allow everybody to know that this is the time that rates could change. And I think with parkland dedication, all these should be at the same time. And it would make sense that year end, since that's what our budget was. But, you know, while you guys did July 31st, might have a reason.
Generally, because new projects begin about late summer, early fall for construction the following year. And so, again, I think if we moved our August adjustments to July, or I'm sorry, to January, we find ourselves in the same circumstance we're talking today for almost every project. So I think it's better to put the PIF back to August.
So
through a revision to the resolution, but we could do that.
So, I would support you bringing that back.
I just got to think from people that are inside or outside of our community, they know there's a certain time of the year that fees are adjusted, and when they take effect, that would certainly be more user-friendly and better communicated.
So just to reiterate, we're fine with it being any specific date,
right?
But it should be one day finished.
Whatever is best for the department.
Exactly.
Perfect. I totally agree.
Yeah. Yeah. So it sounds like we've got a consensus of at least using the 2016 rates, which will result in about a $37,000 additional charge. And there will be an appropriate resolution so that we articulate why we're doing this and avert some precedent setting. Does that make sense?
Very good.
All right, anything else on that topic?
Thanks for bringing it up.
Thank you.
I
appreciate it.
All right, other business, Mr. Wojcik?
Tonight on the agenda, D18 is a contract with Elcon Construction. I noticed they're not doing any work in my ward, but I wanted to encourage Mr. Campion, Mr. Bilderback, and Mr. Ruska to just have a discussion with Public Works on what my experience was with them on a contract last year. There were some issues, and you might just want to verify that the that there's language in place that will ensure the work gets done in a timely manner. Just a little heads up on that. I'm fine with it, but I wanted to at least give you guys the courtesy of relaying my experiences. Transit. My understanding, it's March. Richard, do you know if we're getting a update on the proposal to share some transit services with the district and the city?
I haven't heard a date for
okay.
that coming back to you.
Just appreciate it if we could get an update on when that's going to come back to us then. And I've heard a rumor that there's some people in the community that don't like people riding bikes on the sidewalks downtown.
That's correct.
You can verify that for me. Here's an opportunity, but we have to move quickly if we want to do it by the end of the week for a relatively small amount of money. I sent you all a link to a bicycle pamphlet that's going to be printed. For $1,000, we can get 1,000 copies printed for the city of Rochester, including the customized back page, which could show a map of where bicycling is not allowed on the sidewalks in the community. I figured that, and that would be like $900 for to distribute to staff wherever necessary, and $100 for Barry. And but the idea would be is we could put city logo, We Bike logo, who's a bike MN partner, as well as this map of where there's no biking. So if it's something that we are interested in doing for, again, a relatively small amount of money, the one thing that I can't facilitate on this would be getting a readable image of what exactly the area where you don't have bicycling on the sidewalks downtown. It's questionable whether or not it's clearly defined, but I was basically thinking of basically the 6th Street and 6th Avenue box around downtown. But I would need to staff to provide an image for that. Everything else we could probably take care of through We Bike Rochester, if that's something you're interested in.
Question, comments? I did go to the link. One question I would have is, you can go get the, you can download the brochure yourself,
yes,
free. Could we not then augment that with the city specific, like the maps and so forth, using other technology like our website? So now I can download the brochure if I want, or I can download the map and it's all electronic and I can keep it on my mobile device and so forth.
That would work for the mobile inclined people. I think a lot of the folks you see riding bike downtown probably don't have computer access, or what they do is through the library. You know, it's a lot of low-income folks that tend to ride in the downtown. Again, the only reason I bring this forward is it's a relatively small amount of money, and it gives us a tool in the tool belt to address an issue that's been raised to us a number of times.
It's something else we can hand out to our neighbors to distribute,
yep,
to their neighborhoods. Might be a better way to relay it out.
Is that so?
Mr. Mayor, then.
I was going to bring up one thing. I've interviewed 8 out of the 29 people that applied for the committee, outstanding people, and some of them are already talking about, you know, what kind of education are we going to be doing, and et cetera. And I don't know how urgent this is, but I'm kind of thinking, would it not be smarter to wait until this committee gets pulled together, and there may be other educational pieces that could go on a brochure, and not then have to either have to supplement it later or change something later. Just let bring it up.
Ms. Johnson, then Mr. Woodrick.
I believe our neighbors is printing out a new pamphlet. Is that correct?
It's an ordinance pad.
It is. Mm-hmm. Could that be included in that? Is that something that could be included in that pamphlet?
They're certainly not mutually exclusive. What I wanted to point out is the reason why I'm bringing this up right now is that actually, if we wanted to get the back page available to us, we probably need to have it to them by the end of the week, which is why I would bring it up tonight if there was sufficient interest. Conversely, we can also, I believe, get 1,000 copies without the custom map of where you can't bicycle on the sidewalks for $500 for 1,000 copies. But if we want to have that option of getting the do not bike on the sidewalks area on, there would have to be this week.
Is there any licensing fee associated with this, or is that the raw printing cost?
I couldn't speak to that, but okay. Bike.mn is the group that's doing it, and you know, basically to get the books printed up at 50 cents a piece or whatever, or a dollar a piece is pretty decent for, I think it's like a 20-page booklet.
Mr. Ruskin?
I guess I really agree with what Ardell said. It's if we've got a new committee we're putting together, this gives them a chance to weigh in on it and give some feedback and maybe figure out ultimately the best way to do it. So I don't know that it's needed to be done right now this week. I think that we're close to getting a process in place here which will help this to get done and kind of pull everything together. So I guess I don't have a problem with it. I just think it seems like it makes more sense to wait until this committee can get together and weigh in on it.
Mr. Bilderbach?
The only thing is winter is leaving us fairly rapidly, mm-hmm, and we will be in springtime. We have enough bike riders that are 12 months a year now. My feeling is and we still have school in place, so we can get the information out. If you turn around and you wait too long, we'll be sitting with boxes full of pamphlets and not having areas to distribute. And I think one of the most important things that Michael had said on this is the fact to put the area that bicycles are prohibited on the sidewalks. I think that's pretty important.
Ms. Johnson?
What would the cost be if it wasn't done this week?
Get ones that would like have Hennepin County stuff on the back cover for it'd be the $500 for 1,000 of them. I mean, ultimately, I'm just looking for some guidance tonight. If there's not 4 people that support it, I'm not going to bring it up. So I'm one.
I would tend to want to wait only because I think the issue is more complex than creating a brochure. I think we've got some enforcement things to talk about. You're running into problems today with people riding on the bike on the sidewalk that shouldn't. I think it's going to be a more complex problem than the brochure. Brochure is an education, certainly a component, but I'm interested to hear what other pieces they bring to the committee is able to bring to the table. And And I understand there might be an upcharge to do it later. You know,
it'll be a year from now.
It's insurmountable amount.
Okay.
So it's not that I'm opposed. Just
well, I'm just writing down the yes and no's right now.
Look at what our options are. So one thing I'm interested in is about the digital distribution, whether or not we can actually do that. So it's not clear to me based on what's on their website whether or not this is.
I'm sure we can locally because We Bike Rochester has is a affiliate of Bike MN.
Because if that is possible, I guess I would support waiting.
Okay.
For the whatever we changed the name.
Bicycle and Pedestrian Advisory Committee.
PBAC.
Pedestrian Advisory
Committee. PBAC. But primarily because we can probably host the pamphlet and change it. I think we still have work to do on our side to get an image of where it's not allowed. So
okay.
I'm fine with
it. And two eights.
It comes without an acronym.
That's three.
There is no acronym.
There is not.
Keep telling yourself that, Richard.
No.
PBAC.
Keep telling. Lots of people say all the words in the proper order.
Is it a chain?
All right.
Paul. Hey, Matt, this might be a healthy overlap right now. We Parks and Rec teamed up with Nice Ride on our bike and trail map. And there is an inset with the downtown area. We don't have it marked with where you cannot ride, but it does have a statement about biking on sidewalks is prohibited. So,
okay.
And maybe this would be a way to kind of bridge until we get bring all this together in one effort. But those are we distribute them, and we have them at our facilities, and Nice Ride has their sites, and we've made them available for bike shops and others to use as well.
Mr. Ruska?
I guess I was just something caught my ear that Michael just said about this group is a member of Bike Minnesota, but you said you're still interviewing them. So how can we have be involved, be a member of an organization?
They're different organizations.
Completed the organization yet?
Yeah, the group We Bike Rochester is the group that I sit as affiliate.
Right. So there's. So then, will that go away when we get the new one?
No, that's a whole different.
That's a different.
Okay.
That's a non-governmental.
All right.
So I've got three no's. If I get a fourth one, then it goes down for the night.
I'll wait.
Okay,
I could go either way.
Yeah. No, that's fine. We'll hold off on it then.
In terms of.
Go ahead. What I'll say is I'll see if we can get the whatever the digital image files are called. I forget what they call those, and so we can do our own then as well.
All right, Mr. Campion.
We have a little bit extra time. I realize everyone's got some other things to get to. I just wanted to make sure everyone had an opportunity to read the letter I sent today about tabling indefinitely.
Yep.
And then you saw the response.
I did. Okay. And I wanted to maybe give the council a little bit of insight. My intention is not to have people withdraw their applications as the alternative, but simply to take it off the agenda. If beforehand they can come to us and request something be removed from consideration, I think that should be a reasonable action to take. I'm a little bit dismayed at the idea of putting anything on the table at the request of an applicant. Mm-hmm. Like, the table is for our business and for things we want to put on the table, not for someone to kind of push us into doing. And tabling recently, like I said, came up with a Kashadi project where, because it was put on the table in 2007?
Long time ago.
We had to kind of adjust our entire perspective to this old version. I just think it's something, if we get out of the business stuff and have a clear policy of avoiding, much better than that. So I'm not going to recommend anything tonight, but what I would basically put together for next time is like a request to codify the policy and for the next council meeting.
That's fair. And I have no information to go on, but I suspect one reason they might have done it this way is if they ask to continue, they got to give a date. You ask to table because I don't know a date. It can be tabled forever for that matter.
I guess that's just
suggesting.
That's exactly my concern is like they had to know ahead of the scheduling of the meeting that this wasn't going to be ready. So at what point does an applicant say, put me on the agenda or don't put me on the agenda? And if things are automatically getting on the agenda that are not ready, that to me suggests we need vetting before things go on the agenda. I don't know, maybe no one's here to speak on that, but
Build it back.
Yeah, the thing, and where I agree with Nick on this is the fact that we have too many things that are tabled and we never see it again and it disappears. Or all of a sudden out of the blue it comes back. And I have a problem with having indefinite timelines when we've been dealing with this business. I think my feeling is I'd be happier if they would continue it and have a date on it and then come back at that date and say, no. I'm more uncomfortable with tabled items when we have nothing to go on, when we're going to see it again or not see it again. Our plates are full, and probably overly full, I will say, and I'm a big eater. But it's the fact is we got so much stuff out there, but if somebody's going to pull it, and tell me a date so I can take that piece away for now and then deal with what we need to deal with. I think it takes a valuable time for us. The one that he's talking about, I've had meetings with probably every other week for the last 2-3 months. And I think if it's going to be, when they table it, we can't just set it aside. At least the continued, it has a date, we can leave it sit until that time. So I do have an issue with us tabling projects. I would like to see us readdress that issue.
And I don't disagree with what you're saying. It seems like an applicant has three choices: table, continue, or withdraw.
Yeah.
And so my question is, if they withdraw and then come back at a later date, do they have to pay some fees again?
I mean, I just didn't see it continued so that we have an idea for us, for our benefit. It gives us a date where we don't have to look at it again for a while.
There are bodies where tabled items die after one meeting of sitting on the table. So we could adopt that, is my understanding, is simply you don't put anything on the table that's on a shot clock and it dies after a meeting of sitting on the table. But there is this, you know, when you have this kind of arbitrary 60-day rule that's floating out there because of state law, it's a good law, I understand why it's there, but that works counter to this idea of tabling indefinitely, because in particular this applicant hasn't waived that shot clock. If we were to put it there, they could just buy, and we hadn't said anything about this, they could bide their time for 60 days and say the city hasn't acted.
I just would be careful with that, only because sometimes you table things by choice and you want to leave them on the table forever because you don't want to, for whatever reason. We've got a couple of those. Mm-hmm.
I'm worried, so let me just take this one more step. Right now I can't ask the city attorney about all our outstanding tabled items.
Mm-hmm.
There is no history or record, from my understanding, without poring over a decade's worth of things, probably 6 decades worth of things, to figure out what is tabled and what's not tabled. So it's not surprising to have things like the Kashai thing show up. And what would happen if something showed up that was tabled years and years ago that, you know, we've taken a contrary action to? I think it's a liability for us, basically.
Mr. Miller?
I don't think there's very many. That's my 2 cents worth.
You've done the review.
Frankly, it used to be easier for us to track those years ago in the old system, because with every agenda we'd get paper copies of the ones that were still sitting in the file. And we could see which ones they were, and at a time I don't remember there was any more than 2 or 3. They were just sitting there for a long time. But under the new system, frankly, we have a little more trouble doing that. Brent maybe has a way.
Mr. President, since I've started working in the administration office in 2014, I've been keeping that list. I think there's like 4 items out there that are on the table.
So you know all?
Yep.
Oh. Since 2014.
Since 2014.
Since 2014. Since 2014.
So you didn't know about the Kashati one?
No, that was too far back.
Yeah.
That was in the paper.
So I'm quite certain the technology has advanced far enough that we would be able to find a way to track these. But the bigger issue for me is, you know, why don't we just say January 1st of next year, this is an option that we have, is that we clear the table except for those items that specifically the council wishes to keep on the table.
Mr. Ruskin.
Well, and couldn't we put a limit at a year or something? I mean, you know, you're going back for how long?
Well, since December of 2014.
You know, so, I mean, then you at least got your arms around it a little bit, where, you know, right now, and we could even do that, so then anything that's further out than 2 years is they'll have to start the process over again. And
I think we would have to take some specific action as a governing body. Mr. Atkins can correct me if I'm wrong, but I don't think Robert's rule speaks to that. You can put something on the table, it doesn't say anything about something just expires at some point, or does it?
No, we will use our home rule charter authority where the council sets the rules for its own proceedings to accomplish that.
That's why if we do it on January 1st, we can work that into the rules that we clear the table.
Yeah. I would also say I personally don't like tabling things indefinitely either.
Right, I totally agree. Beyond whether or not we clear the table, there's just this idea of, you know, should people be showing up, putting in the workflow, something that isn't ready? And that's the only reason we need this table indefinitely. So
would we agree that we should forward this item to the Charter Commission?
No.
No.
We have the authority.
No, we have the rules on January 1st. You have the authority now. When it comes time for the next batch of rules and proceedings, which usually is the first meeting in January, you may want staff to add this to the list and draft a rule that would accomplish what you're discussing.
Okay. All right. Ms. Johnson?
When we talk about table and continuing or withdrawing, I don't feel it's council's problem if the applicant isn't ready. I mean, maybe I'm taking a naive view here, but if you put something on the agenda and you're starting a project and you continue to ask for continuances or you want it tabled indefinitely, that should not be our issue. That is, in my opinion, the issue of the applicant. I mean, you can correct me if I'm wrong. But
they have a method for redress. I just don't understand how it works, right? So today, how does an applicant say I'm ready or not ready to call on counsel? It just happens automatically.
There is, once you start the process with the planning department submittal, things happen. Meetings are held before the Planning and Zoning Commission, and then depending upon what happens there, they're scheduled for the appropriate council meeting during which the publication of the appropriate notices occurs.
Okay. So that's the key. If they interrupt the process prior to publication, then that's their option. If they do not,
it's going to happen.
It should happen, and then we should have these options in front of us. You either withdraw it, you hear it, or you continue it to a specific date. Mm-hmm. To me, like, that's a pretty limit. You know, if they come in and say, I'm not ready, we should move it. That's what we should do. That's a good working relationship mm-hmm. with us. Once it's been published, the public is coming, we're studying up, everyone's getting ready.
Right. Here. Just remember that 120 day shot clock starts ticking once the application is submitted.
Which is why they will have to waive it to ask for it to be delayed. I completely agree. We're gonna get this form hemmed out in a matter of a few trial and error. So I'll bring that for next meeting.
I was just gonna say I agree with everything that you're saying. Look forward to bringing forward the updates so we can vote it up or down.
Yep. Thank you for you guys' input. I appreciate it.
All right. Anything else for this afternoon? Mr. Mayor?
A few things real quick at the time. I already mentioned the process that we're going through with all of our interviews, but we've got outstanding so far with the 8 out of the 29 very different perspectives that they have too, which is really exciting to see. We probably could take those 8 right now and say, well, we just need one more and we'd have the 9 done. But no, there's going to be another 21 people to be interviewed and we'll be getting that done. I really don't expect this to come to the council until, at best, the first meeting in April, because some of us are gone next week and trying to get those people's schedule and my schedule together, what we're working at. There's been a couple days this last week that we did 6 interviews because we've got Heritage Preservation, we've got CUED, we've got Police Civil Service, and a whole bunch. So anyway, that's going well. I don't know how many saw that the Minnesota Historical Society has awarded a grant for $4,700 to the park department or to the group to do a condition assessment of the Plummer House water tower. So that's kind of cool that that's happened. And from that, it'll be a step for them to see what necessary historical information they will have to do for the restoration of the tower. So that one is good. Announced today that a long time, over 25 years, Chuck Blattner has been the director of the concert band and choir. He's retiring. I don't know if he's retiring. I'm assuming from maybe out at RCTC too. So they'll be looking for something. They do a great job. And the other was Saturday night was the concert Run Boy Run, both kind of the Appalachian bluegrass, whatever. They're from Arizona. They've been on the Prairie Home Companion. They were here for a full week, one of those residency programs. They have played in 8 of our elementary schools during the week. They played at Wabasha and Preston at elementary schools. And in the evening, they played in Lanesboro, Harmony, Plainview,
Faribault in Cannon Falls. Outstanding concert, and it's also what our civic music department does, not only for Rochester, but this whole southeastern Minnesota area. And I just think that they need to have the old shout out for what they do. And when they get a group like that that's willing to come and spend a whole week basically with kids and then adults, because they're in these communities all the way around, so give them applause too. That's great. That's it.
All right. Anything else? See everyone this evening.
And it was a concert at the
where'd they have it?
The Arts Tournament.
Oh, nice.
Good. I get that shot.
One more to add to the agenda.
Where'd you get any good answers?
Yeah.
You stump anyone?
Some of them I don't have to even, because when I hear them, half of them at least have European experiences.
Yep. Well, no, that's good. But I drive down.
Looking
at the ordinance, you should actually specify residency. So we do have master full moved out of the community.
He doesn't say that he can't be on there, but I think
that was probably
the people
he still
are
works
turn
in the community,
left for church on Wednesday night.
Yeah, the thing that
they
changed
take up
in
the
road,
historic one. But that right turn lane
curves
in.
That worked for whatever
and
EDA.
So
heading east or west, I'm trying to. You were looking
west.
Can't be on there anymore.
No, I was driving from the Walmart past Cottage. Cottagewood and then the church.
Okay, yep.
And it looks like in the plan that little curve is going to remain.
Yeah.
But it makes a choke point because of all the left turners on Wednesday night for the church. So if instead of carrying the curve further down the road, if you started a second lane, a wider lane,
yeah. Okay.
A wider shoulder,
yeah.
Then the people could turn left into the church, and there would still be enough room for a car, whether they're going to make the right turn or the straight, to get past the church person.
I don't know the exact mechanics of that area, and I thought at one point there was some talk about which of the church's accesses would remain. But
they aren't planning on remaining both of them?
I'm not going to speak.
They really kind of need, but really, really